Bill under consideration today is Senate Bill 55. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Teresa McHugh with the Governor's Office. Unless there's other instructions before we get started, I will go ahead and just start the presentation that's, again, focused on the Phase 1 portion or kind of a mission and how are we getting there. And so, again, first page, on page 2, the mission is to provide leadership and direction for all state government operations within the executive branch of government. And one thing that is interesting about the mission, which is a little different from other governor's offices, and we'll talk a little bit more later about specific measurement, is that it really has survived through administrations. It has not gone through a lot of changes through administrations here in terms of Oregon staying very focused on the executive branch. The next page gives you a picture of the organizational structure of the governor's office, and it's a little different than perhaps what you've seen in the past. It does lay out the different sections of the governor's office, not unlike, even the legislative branch or DAS. You do see some things on the organization chart that could be located elsewhere, but are have been located in the governor's office, and so kind of some somewhat separate offices. For example, arrest and return or affirmative action are part of the governor's office. One could argue they could be located elsewhere, but they are part of the structure, and so we will talk more about that. You see a line in some of the boxes. You'll see positions and FTE above the line and positions and FTE below the line. And I think most of you in this committee are aware that over time, if you kind of look at the history of the governor's office, back in the late 80s, governor's office, fairly large, almost all general fund financed, as I recall. And then during the early 90s, a lot of reductions taken in the governor's office, I think cutting the staff almost in half at one point early in the 90s. And over time, a rebuilding of some of the pieces, but funded by other fund or agency support in some cases. Now, in some cases, that was done, for example, if you look on the policy line, and you'll see 10 above and 8 below. For example, our human services policy advisors and the staff there that supports are funded out of the Department of Human Services, by which they can also then be eligible for federal fund match. So in some cases, it's also an opportunity to bring in other funds that otherwise would not be available. And when we move into the next phase and talk more about the details of the budget, you'll be able to get a better sense, and we will go through where all those funds are. But we wanted to kind of give you a clearer picture of the governor's office, of both what's kind of traditionally and supported by the governor's office and what's not there. On page 4, some of the functions in terms of primary functions. Again, the governor appoints most agency heads within the executive branch, and that may be a little bit of a stretch in terms of agency heads if you count all commissions, commission-driven agencies. But if not the agency head, generally the governor is appointing the commission that ultimately appoints the agency director. And again, most large agencies, in fact, in recent years, the legislature has changed some from being commission appointed, such as transportation, to now being governor appointed. Again, responsible for the direction of state agencies within the executive branch, ensuring compliance with the law, being responsive to Oregonians, and management functions.
Yes. Teresa, in your organizational chart here, what has changed from what it previously looked like?
In this budget versus where we exist in effect today?
Yes.
There is one policy package, and that is the Rural Office of Rural Policy. When we get into details, I believe we actually had an elimination of one position in
half-time FTE.
Added
one and a half.
Right, and then we added into the rural policy. So I think it's one position creation and then a movement of one.
Thank you.
And then finally on page 4, the governor does obviously propose a budget for state government to the legislature, which then makes the decision. And finally then, again, the governor does review all legislative enactments, may veto, and of course may be overwritten too. On page 5, in terms of breaking it out, again, my position is to manage the office, advise the governor on executive branch agency issues, and assist in implementing statewide policies. We do have the policy office, and that lists out the pieces there of the policy office. Again, generally focused, similar to the legislative branch, on major policy areas. Some shifting now being done to be more focused around principles and working in teams around those. And again, they formulate policy choices, work with stakeholders both inside and outside, and also deal with federal actions and other actions outside of the state to represent the state. Obviously, during the session, a lot of you and your other ways and means or substantive areas are working with policy advisors on specific issues. Administration, when you look at that category here, is a combination of administrative support. All the communication staff would be in that. My position would be in that. Mail services, or I should say the deputy chief of staffs would be in there. Mail services, those kinds of things. The Office of Legal Counsel then exists separately and advises the governor on legal matters. And again, some of the other things sometimes we don't think about are all the statewide judicial appointments, clemency hearings. A lot of you are probably reading around negotiations with the tribes, the nine tribes, and that role belongs in with legal counsel. And again, looking at litigation special projects, for example, the PERS litigation, as we're working on ballot measure 37, those are generally the kinds of things that legal counsel works on. Page 7, Legislative Affairs. Again, Chris Warner. Hopefully most of you do know Chris, and before that was Pat Egan. We do have somebody that's specifically focused on making sure we work with the legislature in a timely manner. Executive Appointments, focused on appointing or reappointing citizen volunteers to over 200 boards and commissions, thousands and thousands of appointments. One of the most interesting jobs, I think, in the office of working on how do you go out and generate and find the volunteers, and then, frankly, making sure that they have all the legal qualifications to serve, and then working through that process. Citizens Representative Office. This is kind of the avenue for citizens to contact the office. Often this has been called the ombudsman's function, if you think about the past, that kind of thing. It does work with state agencies and has two full-time positions and then three that actually come from agencies. Primarily, what we do is rotate and affect support by the agencies that, in effect, have the most questions and concerns coming in. And in effect, this is a clearinghouse that then gets all of this information back out and ensures that people are getting answers. And in some cases, people only want to give their opinions. They don't really need a response. But in many cases, they have run into some problem with government and want to have the governor's office assist in helping them get through the process to get an answer. In 2004, over 66,000 contacts in that year. I think the highest year was actually 2003 with over 100,000 contacts. The biggest change that we've seen in this office over the years is email has made this a much more accessible office. And in 2002, we received about 8,500 emails. In 2004, 22,000. And this year, we watched the number escalate as people have become much more familiar with email. And the governor has actually promoted his website in that respect. We are watching those numbers go up. But again, that's the function of this office. The next page is the Economic Revitalization Team. This was created by the 72nd Legislative Assembly. And it was to focus state agency resources. Oh, yes.
Excuse me, Teresa, where are the ombudsmen listed under the chart up here?
If you would go back to the org chart on page 3, if you see the Citizens Rep Office, you'll see two positions up above, three below. And again, the two are full-time funded within the governor's office. The three, in effect, it's a rotating piece with agencies. There are still some that are dedicated. Human Services, for example, I believe is still more dedicated source from there because of just the number that come from there.
May I follow up? Yes. How many are there altogether in the state agencies and governor?
I believe this is it now because there was one that used to exist in the Department of Corrections. Now I'm going back to my memory from my previous life, and that was eliminated in 01, I believe. And
I thought I saw 8 somewhere on a list.
There may recently. Be. We can take a look at that and find out there's others. There may be, for example, sometimes what happens is, for example, you see underneath the MWESB, Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, Lydia Muniz, the woman who is, in effect, in the governor's office, is the governor's advocate. So sometimes other people get connected with that. But the public safety advocate that used to exist, that position was eliminated and absorbed then within our office. But we'll take a look and see if there's others.
May I follow? The definition of alms Buddhism historically is one who cuts through red tape. I don't know. The only person I know that does that in state government is Nikki Cerise with the Service to Children and Families, and he will contact the person that I call about, and then he will take a look at who is, you know, the staff people, and he will actually make changes. I mean, he does what I think an ombudsman person should do. I don't know if that's the role, though. The role is...
Senator Moore said, it depends on the issue. Yeah. Again, when you look at the number of contacts, to some degree, and we do also use a lot of volunteers in effect to screen, but when you look at the number of contacts, that's one of the issues. But what they do is ensure that something is happening. They coordinate, and we're working on that actually right now, of how we coordinate what they're hearing with our policy advisors so that we ensure the follow-up happens. Agencies have to have processes in place to make sure that we know they are responding. Are they always responding in the same way of actually cutting through all the red tape? I can't answer today and say it's happening in every case, but that is certainly the intent, is to make sure that people are finally finding... They've reached out to this office generally because they have finally reached a point, if they're asking for kind of that intervention, where they can't get through. But I think it depends on each situation, but I think some of that does occur.
If you can get some information.
Yeah, we can. Yeah,
in general, about the role of those
individuals. Sure, and we'll also look at the other advocates that exist.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Back to page 9, then. The Economic Revitalization Team. Actually, some of that came out of, I think, some of you have seen that situation, of seeing situations around the state where there were opportunities for communities around economic development or community development, but dealing with the 6 or 7 or 8 or more state, not to speak of other governmental entities, to deal with making that happen was a real issue. And that's been the goal of this group, is to cut through those barriers and to create, if you will, instead of kind of the vertical having to deal with all of those, but a horizontal, how do you get movement there is to do that work. And certainly we are seeing some of those pieces come into place. I don't know how many of you are aware of the Google site that is now coming. Google is planning to locate in the Dalles. And in effect, it was this kind of work that helped make that happen. So we are seeing real results from that. And again, as we go into the next phases, we can certainly give you more information about how that's working. But that was the goal, was to, again, to some degree, help communities deal with all of the issues that occur. And again, history, some of this came out of locating a prison in a community but not worrying about or being able to help deal with issues such as, what is their housing need, what are their water needs, what are their education needs, now that you've brought this to the community. Page 10, Office of Rural Policy. This is, there was discussion last session. The governor did issue an executive order, and we've begun the process here. This is a policy package for us. Again, we did a shift of some resources within the governor's office here, but we also do have a policy package. About 65,000 of the funding has come from the federal government. We're intending to go, again, asking for federal fund support here. But again, the whole piece being of working with the rural parts of the state to do needs assessment, issues inventory, and frankly, to try and bring more data in here about the different needs of the rural communities. One of the things that's brought to me as a frustration by members is often we treat rural as one big rural, and rural needs are different around the state. So in terms of getting data here that really talks about the different issues out there, and then how do you apply resources appropriately, is one of the issues here.
Yeah. Question.
Thank you. I've been working with Karen Whitaker at OHSU. Mm-hmm. That's... Is that connected to the rural development in the governor's office at all?
Senator Moore said it's not within the governor's office, but I know those conversations are taking place to, again, not have dual efforts out there, but to work together. Theirs is more focused on the health issues, but, and this is broader, but yes.
Yeah. Well, may I? As the chair of the health committee, health services, I've been working very hard to try to extend some rural health initiatives and money into a foundation which was created by statute in 93, and I'd like to talk with you about that. If you have access through your office to some federal funds that could be used as a kind of a rotating fund. We're trying to establish a fund that could be used to make grants and loans and so on to a variety of rural health facilities, but it's kind of frustrating because OHSU has been cut, I think, by 40%, and that, some of that's reflected in health care. But I'd like to talk with you about
that. Happy to do that.
Later. Thank you.
Teresa,
yes.
Question. The statement, results will be used to develop recommended principles for an economic development plan. That's a prospective statement. When do you see some of these things beginning to materialize? I presume in time for some prospective action in this assembly.
Senator Morris, we would hope some of that would be here. Jim Osimano, I don't know if all of you have had a chance to meet him, just recently joined our staff, so it's we are early in the process, although, again, working very closely with the local government folks. So I can find out more about what's going to be available this time, with also then kind of the connection of how is it moving into a longer-term focus. But, yeah, we would hope that some of it would be available now, too. Page 11 talks about the minority, women, and emerging small businesses, and gives you some information on that. One of the things I should make clear is, for anybody here who's heard the Department of Consumer and Business Services budget, you probably heard about this as well, because there are two pieces to this. It did, prior to 1995, it was all located together where the advocate was located with, in effect, the office, and a decision was made that the advocate, who in a sense is speaking up for minority women and emerging small businesses and looking at state contracting and purchasing to make sure that it is compliant, should be in a separate facility, in effect, they can work together but should be separated so that they aren't, in effect, just becoming part of the office but truly can be an advocate. And it was moved to the governor's office at that time. And again, that office does prepare an annual report that comes to the governor and also comes to the legislature on the status. And they do work on all the state contracts, so kind of in excess of over $200 million of total funds that they help to provide a clearinghouse to make sure that those are handled appropriately according to the law. Page 12, affirmative action. This again has, I believe this office has at least for a decade existed in the governor's office. There was a period of time where it existed in the Department of Administrative Services, and again under the same kind of theory of saying it, you need to step up in terms of a leadership role. And this is again to look at equal employment opportunities and retention for all citizens in state government. This office also works on issues around training as well as recruitment and retention, and works with the local governments and private sector as well. Page 13, arrest and return or the extradition process. Again, something that people don't always think of with the governor's office, but that office is located within the governor's office. Works with the 36 counties, Department of Corrections, Parole Board, PSRB, to return fugitives to the state of Oregon within the funding. And then finally, on page 14, sustainability, and again, small unit funded by the agencies that have the sustainability efforts to look at sustainability plans over time in accordance with the executive order and in accordance with the laws around sustainability. And you see some of the issues they're working on. Some of the kinds of things that that group and that board has done is, for example, DAS, Department of Administrative Services, and the Department of Energy took on a very kind of comprehensive look at energy within state buildings and ways to do that, and did achieve a 17% reduction between 2000 and 2003. So, again, saving over $1 million in that project. Part of the goal here is to create an environment where, though, this is actually built into how agencies manage their businesses. Page 15 then takes you into the numbers. The total budget is slightly over $11 million, and you can see the vast majority is in that administration component, the policy folks. Largely staff-driven in that area, so very similar to some other places that when we aren't an office in that piece that does a lot of pass-through to other folks, it is spent on salaries. arrest and return, again, not staff-driven in that case. Most of that money is spent on actual transport of fugitives. Affirmative action, again, you see some of that's contract money there. Most of that money, as well as MWESB at the bottom, Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, is assessment-based through the personnel assessment to state agencies. Economic revitalization team and at 16%, and that's, you'll see a little bit, that's a combination of other funds and lottery funds, and then Office of Rural Policy, again, partially federal funds and the rest other funds. And page 16 then lays it out by those fund types. So basic information, moving into performance measures on page 17. The first thing I would say on performance measures before we get into the pieces is one of the things...
Mr. Chair? Question 3, go back to 16 for a moment, mm-hmm. please. Other funds is... that's a lot of different sources of money, is it not?
It is.
Okay. Could you provide, or is it in the documentation, is it provided for later precisely what the individual assessments of agencies that make up those other funds?
We can do that because it is a combination. Some, for example, affirmative action, all agencies use that function and pay that portion. Other pieces, such as the policy advisor for human services or the policy advisor for corrections, for example, then that agency is paying that share. So we can give you a picture of that. Then back to performance measures. One of the things I've done in my few months now in the governor's office is take a look at looking at overall measurement for a leadership-type office. And we are looking, we've talked to NGA, and we're looking at some other states, as well as looking at legislative leadership offices, because there is some similarity in terms of that, and looking for some broader measures. We are not having universal success on that, although we are continuing to look at what are some kind of broader measurement tools that we can use that are more generic overall around leadership of the state. And education and some other issues around the state. Certainly the governor, in terms of looking at the details from agencies, considers that also important to a reflection on the governor's office. But we are in that process right now. And so any help that you have as you're finding things that are broader in leadership, we would appreciate. But we are looking at those right now. In terms of more specific items, though, then you can see we do have specific measures to a lot of the specific offices in the governor's office. And starting with the economic revitalization team, you have everything from the customer satisfaction survey to the opportunity sites identified by the Industrial Lands Advisory Committee, remembering we are working very hard on having certified shovel-ready industrial sites around the state for making sure that we are poised, if you will, to bring business into the state and have it ready for those purposes. And then, of course, just the number of new sites and acres certified as project ready. And the next several pages then give you the graphic display of each one of those, showing where we are today as well as where our target is. So you can see, in terms of opportunity sites identified, we are above the target. In terms of those certified as project ready, we aren't quite at the 30 we would like to have. We're at 22 today. We are seeing some of those be picked up and used, and again, we're continuing to work through that.
Teresa, Mr. Chair, if I may, why do you have such a drop from 30 to 20, or do you think 20 is really that static target that you need to be at?
Representative Krupp, if you don't mind, I would bring Ray Knapp to the table, and I think he might be a better person to answer that question and give you a more accurate answer than I might. And make it useful. I'm glad he had an opportunity. I'm just sitting back there.
I prefer just to sit back there. My name is Ray Knapp. I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Relations for the Governor. Basically, Representative, the idea here was to, first of all, have that 30 as an initial goal, and then over time, if we could add 20 a year was the idea, so you'd have a cumulative effect in terms of the total numbers of industrial sites. One of the things we found as we got into certification of industrial sites is that the low-hanging fruit, if you will, a number of the sites that were initially selected pretty much had a number of the infrastructure things in place, and as we move further down the road, the sites become more complicated to actually certify. There are greater needs, but the whole idea is just to have a running cumulative total of these sites over the course of the next 5 to 8 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ray.
Question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the number 20, is that, do you get to that number based on your capacity to go out and find and develop these sites, or is it based on some other criteria?
It's a combination. It's certainly it's capacity driven to a degree, but it was also just in terms of the sheer volume of what we've got out there, in terms of what probably capacity is as good an answer as I can give you, because it's just to get more than that, beyond that, becomes somewhat problematic. I mean, we could attach a 40 to it a year. The reality is we're probably just not going to be able to get there.
Problematic in what sense?
Problematic in the sense of the time, the effort, and the energy that the various agencies and the economic revitalization team have to devote to it, just the sheer volume of it.
And Representative Vaki, we're also wanting to make sure we're very careful about not just developing sites to say we have a developed site, but making sure it does link up with really with real possibility of bringing in industry to that site.
Okay, and now you're hitting at what I was getting at. Is it your sense that that is what you would be doing if you had more capacity to go out and target sites, or is there a need out there that isn't being addressed because you don't have the capacity?
Representative Vaki, I think the first place was it was very clear that there was a need that started this whole project. In terms of matchup, and at this point in the foreseeable future, we don't see reaching that place where we are now just developing sites to develop sites. Certainly there's going to be issues that come up at some point here, and probably not in the too distant future, where you start looking at issues of, now that you're in this business, of size of sites, location, where as we look out around the economy, do we need fewer small sites, and is it time to look at some other kinds of, you know, larger footprint sites if somebody really wanted to bring a larger headquarters here? And some of those issues are now coming to the table. But when we started, it was basically such a need that it was pretty easy to fill and have appropriate sites, is my understanding. Is that mm-hmm. Would you add anything to that?
No.
Yeah, thank you. Are your sites, do they coincide with local enterprise zones?
Sometimes, yes. I mean, part of this whole process is we try to work very closely. The local government piece and the local factors that are put into play are very much a part of what's driving this. It's not the state going in and acting independently. It's the state, city, and or county all working together.
How do you see the effectiveness of the local enterprise zone, particularly in rural Oregon? Or do we need more of them?
I'm not sure I can comment with any great degree of accuracy on that, sir.
Well, having been the mayor of Springfield when we landed and are still landing companies, the enterprise zone is probably the very best tool to use for economic development, and I support them. It's a local decision, but I think that they're great.
Before you begin, Teresa, again, just a commentary. The effort of the economic revitalization team is laudable, you know, to pick major sites. But I believe the real issue is not picking these, what would be relatively very few sites in Oregon, but to understand the process that the smaller businesses go through, the people that are in Oregon that are trying to accomplish something. And in terms of the performance measure, would be to measure the time it takes from the time that you initiate something to the time that you actually get it into the ground and you're putting concrete into the ground. And we convened a kind of a little focus group with some developers in the Portland area, and the statement was made that it took them, even after they had the land use approval, it took them 18 months to go through the site design review and all of the, and I call it honestly brain damage, that you go through to try to accomplish something. It took them 18 months to get that first shovel in the ground and put concrete in for footings on average. And those are the kinds of things that create impediments to development in our state. And so while these efforts are laudable, I mean, it's good, we've got to look at the smaller businesses and say, how do we help them in this process? Because it is not easy to do business in Oregon.
Senator Morris, and for small business, but I would say some of the large businesses would say the same thing. And,
yes.
And it's not included here, but perhaps as we get further into this, we can bring in some of the work that's being done around the regulatory reform that's similar. It's not an office as such, but the same kind of idea of looking at everything from permitting to working with the federal government on what are the issues that are causing people to have such a long period of time, even after they have, in effect, the location chosen. So, again, we don't have that in here because it doesn't exist as such, but that work is ongoing, and part of its measurement for us is, are you reducing the length of time it takes for a business to go from a decision to want to locate in Oregon to being able to open their doors and hire people and go to work?
Hyman is one of the greatest enemies of any business enterprise that's wanting to locate and create something.
Absolutely. No, would agree.
Thank you.
Page 21, then, it's similar. It just gives you an idea of, as we're out looking for acreage and finding industrial acres certified as project ready. And, again, very similar measurement. Just looks at it from an acreage standpoint. And the next page deals with the customer satisfaction piece, which is the percentage of the local participants who rank the process as very good to excellent. And again, pretty ambitious target out there, hoping to get to 100%. But clearly understanding that, I think your point is well taken there, Senator Morris. To get to the 100%, it can't just be that we got them a shovel-ready site. It is going to include then having to deal with other issues that are out there in communities and from the state side. Page 23 then moves into minority women and emerging small businesses, and page 24 is affirmative action. And in both cases, what you can see is plans are in place. They are both working on tracking mechanisms and data bases to be able to gather data. We do have some data in these areas around what the state is doing. They are a little... this has been an area where there's been some trouble in the sense of concerns about targets, because with these areas there's federal prohibitions on targets, and so that's caused some kind of, I think, more semantic maybe problem in terms of getting some of these things up, but we are looking for ways to be able to provide better data on what's happening. So we actually, as we get in the next phase of this, we'll be able to give you a lot of data of what's happened, but in terms of really going forward and then talking about where does the state want to be. On both of those.
Mr. Chair, is there any coordination in your in this tracking with other local government entities? For instance, the city of Portland that does a significant amount of contracting with especially minority businesses. And I ask the question because just because they're not working for the state of Oregon doesn't mean that opportunities aren't being created somewhere else. So how do you coordinate your targeting?
Representative Avakian, in terms of, let me start with minority women and emerging small businesses. I would hate to use the word coordination yet in a very tangible way, because I think there's much more that can be done there is what I'm hearing. But there is something kind of like a council. It's not a state council, but there is an association of minority women emerging small business entrepreneurs, in effect, that in effect is, to some degree, a watchdog on the systems to make sure that they are working to be in compliance with the law, but also be very effective in terms of looking at those issues. And they worry less about whether it's a state contract or a county contract or a city contract. They are working across the board. I think I know in both cases, the advocates in these positions work very closely, a lot, I would say, with the Portland, the city of Portland and Multnomah County, but they are trying to look statewide. Is it what I would call a full kind of government approach statewide yet in these areas? No, it's not. But there is work that's being done to do more coordination and look at contracts across the board, not just state contracts.
I don't know that that there is an answer that exists to this, but maybe that's partially where my questioning comes from. Is where do we, how do we know whether or not the state has got any kind of a duty or an obligation or even serving a need in this area, other than what this particular watchdog group tells us? If we don't have a very good way of exchanging information with local governments to see how contracts are being granted, I don't know what the state's role is with regard to this, and I haven't heard anything in the other committee or from you yet today that makes me any more comfortable that the state even knows what its role is.
It's a very good question, and frankly, I'd like to have Lydia Muniz maybe give you a call and talk to you a little bit more about that. In my capacity in the last 6 months, I can't say that I do have an answer I'd want to give you today and say, no, this is exactly what our role is. You know, I know there's a relationship. I know their focus is, again, primarily on the state portion, or Lydia's is, on the state contracts, but I do know there's a relationship. How concrete it is and whether or not the role is more of a support and an informal role versus a formal, I feel more comfortable with her knowledge of getting in touch with you.
Do me a favor, don't ever call me, because I don't think that information is going to help me with this Ways and Means process, but maybe some other time we'll talk about
and,
it.
And as we come back into our next phase, we'll see if we can have something a little more tangible, and I can bring that back.
Okay.
So again, and that was talking about both minority women and emerging small business. And again, in affirmative action, you see a real focus on a little different than maybe what we've seen in the past, which was a focus on all agencies, which, while it's important, you all are becoming aware, I guess you all actually have all been here, how many agencies have one or two people they hire versus large staff. And so you see a real focusing on the 30 larger agencies that in effect are the staff-driven parts of what the state does, and especially those that are statewide. Page 25, again, extradition process, arrest and return. And you have everything. You have several measures, from the number of extradition returns completed to present that use the low-cost means, which means that, in effect, we can actually be able to meet more of the extraditions. And so the next three really are the form of extradition, and then the last one being the average cost per extradition. And so you can go through those and see that, in general, you see the number of extraditions completed, as well as the form of transportation. And again, the reason you see that is the shuttle van transportation that actually is fairly new, I would say in the last 6 or 7 years probably, has really increased the number of extraditions that the state was able to complete. It saved a significant amount of money. I believe the first biennium it was up, it saved over $100,000, and the second biennium over $900,000 from the traditional forms of extradition. So it has been an ability then to turn that money back in to more extraditions.
Grisha, we send a state van to wherever to pick up a prisoner and bring it back? Is that how that shuttle works?
I'll talk more about the detail. It's an interesting process.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kelly Frizz with Budget Management. It actually is a county-run system where the state provides the vans and some of the equipment, and the counties do coordination. It's actually 11 western states coordinate to move prisoners throughout the system. Once it's defined that the local entity wants them back, then what this system does is allow a mechanism to get the prisoner there in the least cost fashion. So it's actually the local government of the local counties that do the transportation back and forth.
Right. And in general, in the governor's office, you won't see a lot of capital outlay. You will here, because part of their funding goes to the purchase of these vehicles, in effect, for the counties. But it is an interesting system, but it has been very cost-effective and allowed us to have this peak of where we had a lot of extraditions sitting out there that hadn't been serviced to be able to deal with it.
just to follow up, if we had an extradition from New Mexico, it's conceivable we might pay to have a New Mexico van deliver that prisoner, or these vans float throughout the 11 different states?
I would prefer not to use New Mexico because they're not part of the PAC, Mr. Chair.
Okay, excuse me.
Let's use North Dakota because they are part of it.
Okay.
And there was actually a mechanism where North Dakota transports it to, and I don't know my states well enough, all the way through to Idaho and gets it to Oregon just through the transportation network. And what happens is they transport them during the day, hold them in the local jail at night, and then transport them the next day to the next destination. So it's a system that...
It's truly a shuttle. So the vans stay within a certain area.
Right. They'll hand them off.
Okay.
Wow.
From jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
And we, it's reciprocal. So we're Oregon sending folks to California and to Washington and to Idaho. Some of them are going to other states. Some of them are staying within that state.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does that include extraditions to Canada and Mexico, or is that purely a federal issue?
I don't believe this includes any of those.
I don't believe
so. I think
so.
That's all federal.
Thank you.
So, again, several issues there. And, of course, one of the things, though, that does play in as you look at some of the numbers are oil prices then do impact this budget a little bit. But, and then on page 31, we move into the policy option package. We have one, and it's to continue and, in effect, to formalize the Office of Rural Policy into the budget. And, again, we talked some about that, but the bottom line is we're looking for about $250,000 in other funds. This, at this point, is more of a target of what we're looking at. We're looking at everything from grants to if we have agencies that need specific work done, and it's better done by this office, picking up some of those costs, and then, of course, the federal funds. And two positions, actually one and a half FTE.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Do you have, it seems to me that there's a direct connection between the Office of Rural Policy and economic development. So I would assume that economic development funds would be one of the targets you would have for other funds.
It could be, right.
Okay.
And part of that is going to come out as we talk about really formalizing this office and having discussions with the legislative body as well about the use of this office and making sure that it's meeting the goals of the legislature as well. We'll then also set out some of its work scope.
Yes.
Page 32, then, as we developed a criteria to be used for prioritization, the first thing was, frankly, to ensure that state agencies are responsible stewards of the public's resources. Again, taking on very clearly to go back to the mission of the governor's office to direct and ensure that state agencies are fulfilling their duties. And so, again, this includes providing direction and planning for both efficient and effective delivery of programs and services, and of course, it's, as is with the legislature, very involved with relationships statewide, including with business, nonprofits, local governments, as well as from agency to agency, and trying to create more of a, again, as you see in the economic revitalization, certainly as the governor approached the principal process, trying to get agencies to look outside of their own borders and figure out how they can work as a team to better use the state's resources. Obviously, growing Oregon's economy is a huge priority for the governor. Investing in state resources that actually are part of the long-term vision for creating jobs and recruiting and retaining Oregon businesses, and then making government transparent, accessible, and accountable to citizens, and then having a budget that focuses, again, as we talked about, on long-term and is driven by the principles. So in terms of order of priority, again, and I'm sure you run into this with other offices and smaller offices, we put this in an order by those major categories, and you see administration, which, again, is the core part of the office, being first, the economic revitalization, second, Office of Rural Policy. And, again, as we get into the other pieces here, then, the advocate for minority women and emerging small business, affirmative action, extradition, and finally sustainability, one of the reasons you see that as well is, again, these tend to be those things that have become attached to the governor's office for leadership issues but are not necessarily as much of a core set and could actually be moved within other agencies as well. As we looked at a 10% reduction in terms of general fund again, then, as I mentioned, general fund is staff-driven. So, in effect, it's probably about four positions to management. And, again, management for the governor's office is not necessarily traditional supervisory. These are policy advisors, those kinds of positions, and then two support staff positions. In terms of capital outlay, we really have it in one place, as we talked about. It's a rest and return. And again, then what we would it would do is, just like I think some of your offices, we already, as we talked about, take an advocate role and really being able to deal with some of the issues, it would just, again, weaken us in terms of our ability to respond to working with our partners and to do both the monitoring as well as proactive kind of work to meet our mission. And in terms of the capital outlay, it would be van purchase and related equipment to keep that shuttle service running. That's where those dollars go. On page 35, our lottery funds, we exist in one place, and that's the economic revitalization team. So we would, again, that team is, again, fairly largely staff-driven, so it would be a reduction of a manager. And again, same kind of issue in terms of responsiveness of being able to deal with the issues out there. In other funds, the target's about $178,000, and you see the elimination of one technical position. And at this point, we have named down here affirmative action, but again, as we go into further discussions with you, we would want to have the discussion of whether it's too part-time or how that works. But in effect, it's going to be staff-driven, and it would be position-related.
Does that, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Does that put us at risk of losing any federal funds by not being in compliance with an affirmative action plan?
I think as you look into the other funds, yes. I mean, I think, again, one of the things over time, if you look at the governor's office over time, and again, not to single it out, because certainly legislative offices went through this and everybody did, it's become a pretty small functioning office as you look relative to other states, even other states of our size. And so when you get into this area now, we are talking about areas that are already we already work in a pretty cooperative way with just kind of leadership from the office, so we always worry about the downside. In affirmative action, the downside could be compliance. It could also be just seeing number of lawsuits go up, number of and in fact, you know, our recruitment and retention not working as well. So it's everything from very serious consequences to those that may not show up for a while, to kind of the long-term problem. And then finally, in federal funds, again, exists in one place, Office of Rural Policy, so again, staff-driven, we would take a reduction there. And again, that's the presentation. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? I've been intrigued with the organizational relationships that exist between the governor and his office and all of the agencies, and the role of the director of DAS, your role as chief of staff, and how the governor relates from an administrative standpoint, just the function of the business of government. How does that all fit together in an operating sense? And I'm coming from this from the standpoint of the role that I played in my company as a CEO and president, and the kind of relationships that I had in just terms of running things. How does that work?
Before you answer, can I add something to your question?
Yes.
In addition to the agencies like DAS, the structure of your relationship to the state school superintendent, the commissioner, and the Bureau of Labor, and how that fits into the executive branch of government as well.
I think Senator Morris and Representative Vakian, and in respect for your time, I know I'm becoming a historian here, so I won't go back too far, but having watched a number of governors and chiefs of staff and directors of DAS as well as of agencies, the first thing I will say is I think to some degree the structure is not going to be constant. It is going to change with the governor that is in place as the CEO of a company would change the structure in terms of what do they see as their primary role. The governor, as he looked looks, this governor's, he looks at state agencies. And he has a little different perspective, having existed in several roles in state government that maybe other governors have not had, because he has existed. I mean, he was an agency director, so he related to all of these people as an agency director back in, I'm not going to remember what year, but he was the director of what was then the Department of Insurance and Finance. And, of course, he's been the attorney general. And so he has a little different perspective. In terms of the role, then, as he came in, he sees DAS as very clearly a coordinating arm for the executive branch, and clearly playing a role in terms of making sure that the information, when you talk about accountability, that the state is able to be accountable and have information, data-driven information, that is able to evaluate that accountability structure. In terms of working directly with agencies, he largely holds both DAS, he holds my position, as well as then advisors, as kind of key roles in making sure that coordination takes place. And frankly, he is less likely to bring agencies in agency by agency, but again, more around a cluster or an issue to talk about how to best resolve the issues. So that's a little different structure. If you think about an org chart, I would say the other piece is just like the personality and the knowledge base that he brings, lay some of that in place. Certainly, the role of Peter Bragman was different than my role in that office, in the sense that as I come into that office, my skill set and my background has a lot to do with the management of agencies. So, in effect, he has asked me to maintain some of that piece directly in the governor's office. And I think would say that he personally believed that the governor's office in the past, no matter how good the DAS director was somewhat disengaged from that, and believes that some of that accountability and being directly involved in the management of the agencies should reside in the office. And so that is a role he has asked me to maintain in that function. So that's kind of the first piece. And the DAS director and I meet regularly and in effect create a team. So, if you will, they are the nonpartisan objective technical arm, as well as the accountability arm of making sure that's there. And it's in both ways. One side's the accountability, or if you will, what we kind of think of as the control function. The other is, in effect, the technical assistance, the office that helps make sure that agencies have the tools they need to know how to be in compliance. And so there's that element as well. So I don't know if that helps to answer your first question, but I think that's kind of the first piece, is that for me in that role, that he has basically said the governor's office must be closer to the daily management of agencies and making sure that they are, in effect, meeting my requirements for them as executive branch agencies. Now, again, as with all things, tomorrow I win the lottery, and I do know I am finding out you have to play to win the lottery, and you know, and even then I don't know that it would. I have teenage daughters. I'm not sure it would be enough to maintain what they would their life. So, but if I were not there and you brought somebody else in, then I think he would, again, he is very much in tune with then evaluating and making sure that the people have the skill set to do it, those roles. So he is a little more fluid that way of making sure those roles are in place. Having moved into the next piece,
Before you move to the next piece, if I may.
First, may I apologize for being late? This was one of these mornings, if I touched it, it went wrong. So, I profoundly apologize.
We're doing well this morning. Maybe you want to...
Yeah, don't get out of the wall. Anyway, I'm sorry.
With respect to an agency such as DAS or DCBS or something, do you view the governor's office as having unilateral authority to manage the budgets of those agencies? Now, I understand you're working in a cooperative process with those agency heads to achieve goals and have them, but if you have the authority, if you choose to dictate their management of the budget.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, I would say in my history I've never seen anyone take it as kind of that, what I would call that unilateral approach. I think, and Oregon, I think, has some unique features that also help there. For example, Kelly City.
Now, mind you, I'm not asking what the practice is. I'm asking if you think that you have the authority.
If legally there's the authority? I would say that the first thing is unilaterally, no. The appropriations process is pretty, you cannot violate the appropriations process. I think the law is very clear and the Constitution on that. So a governor must live within that. Now, that can be as specific or as broad as the legislature deems it to be. And frankly, the consequences either way are consequences for everybody. One of the things I have found over time is that they sometimes can be as difficult for the legislature as they are for the executive. I mean, to some degree, we have some of the same issues. But again, I think the appropriations process first is one of those things that the governor does not have the ability to change. The second piece is within the statutes then are some clear rules about within that, then how do you function. So again, agency by agency would answer that question. Now, having said that, that piece, then for some agencies, there's very little movement a governor can apply because the dedication of the funds, the way the appropriation bill is written, the other statutory pieces that are there would make it very hard for a governor to have a whole lot of wiggle room, if you will, around that. Other agencies, there is a lot more authority within still making sure that you can make sure that their mission that exists in statute or the programs that exist in statute are completed. So there's always kind of that piece. Clearly, a governor does not have the authority to just unilaterally walk in and say, I now want you to do X instead of Y, I think in any case. Beyond that, in terms of saying, how do we get there, and how do we manage these funds, and how do we make sure that we achieve the missions and these programs, there is some flexibility. And I don't know if that completely answers your question, but Oregon is not as clean cut as some states, that it does vary agency by agency in terms of a governor's authority.
I think it's a good start. But I interrupted you. You were going to move, I think, to other...
Into the other elected officials. Yes. Yes, that's a good point. Madam Chair, Representative Avakian. Again, the other thing I think that surprises governors when they get elected... I think surprises the citizens when you go out and talk to them, and sometimes you can't convince them of this, frankly, is some of the things that Oregon has in statute or in other cases in the Constitution that in effect also are things that control the power of the executive. One of those is that a number of agencies still exist where the governor does not hire or fire the agency management or the team underneath them. That agency manager. That is a role for the commission. Now, the governor generally appoints the commission. However, the governor doesn't have, again, unilaterally the authority to just, in effect, terminate commission members. That is also different agency by agency. And in some cases, commission members can only be removed for cause. In some cases, it's after public hearings. And, I mean, there's all sorts of, again, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's a very different kind of approach. So, again, the governor's approach does vary by whether or not he has this person works directly for him. In terms of the other elected officials, it has always been something unique to Oregon, although every state has their own set. They're different in every state. But, for example, when we put the budget together, the constitutional officers, as well as the other branches of government, are not under the executive control in terms of looking at what they do or why they do it or what order they put it in. Or the only thing the executive does is Oregon does run with a single budget system, so we do make sure that as they apply inflation factors or whatever, those are through the system. Now, if they don't apply them correctly, we can't change them, but we can notify, and LFO then picks up that role of notifying the legislature and saying this is how this was done. The three statewide elected but non-constitutional Bureau of Labor, Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Attorney General, do go, for example, through the budget process, and they are technically part of the executive branch for those purposes. So it is a hybrid relationship, but clearly they all act with much more of their own authority. For example, if an agency said, I really don't care, Governor, that you believe the best way to reach our mission is this, I'm going to go over here and advocate for this. That is not something that, again, as a CEO and for this person working for them, the governor has a lot of authority to deal with, especially if it's a direct appointed position. With the statewide elected officials, they are completely in control of being able to come and run their own agendas. So there is communication. The statewide elected officers do try to meet, but it is certainly a hybrid situation. And again, always one of those interesting things. Had a community group that said, boy, I think we should just go out and not at the state level, but at local level, pick out 10 superintendents around the state and fire them. And no matter how many times we had the discussion of superintendents are not hired of the school districts by the governor, in fact, not by the state at all, we couldn't quite make headway there. Doesn't matter, take their money away, do something, but, you know, so it's one of those kind of hybrid situations and is different almost agency by agency.
Are you done?
Senator Morris.
Thank you. This discussion is causing me a little bit of concern because it's kind of shattered a myth that I had about the role of the governor in this state. In this budget environment we've been in, we've had, and rightfully so, any organization that has a revenue, you know, that's the problem. It forces you to go back and look internally at how you're operating to create greater efficiencies, and that's what the public is wanting. But what I see, and as you described the governor's authority, a real disconnect in the ability to really attack that issue. Our role, and particularly in Ways and Means, is very limited. You know, quite frankly, very limited. We started at a high level, and we never get much below 30,000 feet. And that's just the nature. You know, we can look at the policy issue, we can look at the broad indicators and you know, kind of move around in that area. But in terms of really influencing how services are delivered, that's beyond our constitutional authority, quite frankly, I'm sure. But yet what I hear you saying is that the governor is quite disconnected from that process from an organizational and authority standpoint as well. So it seems, I mean, it's kind of an emerging this vision of a kind of a systemic problem in the way our government is organized to create a you know, highly performing organization.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think, first of all, some of that has been recognized. I think one of the things, I don't mean to send the message, it's such a, you know, it is a hybrid, but over time, you would find that the, what you would probably call a major state agency, most now are direct appointed by the governor. And again, just recently, Department of Transportation, the last in my history, became one that came out of issues very similar to this. So you would find today out of the 110 agencies or whatever the number is today, at one point it was 110, an awful lot of them are very small licensing boards, those kinds of things. And again, most of those are in effect still not direct appointments of the governor. I would not underestimate, while you certainly stay at a higher level, remembering most of those are smaller agencies, I would not underestimate the influence of the legislature, though, as well as the governor in those processes. The agencies, again, even though Ways and Means is generally a fairly short process, the emergency board does exist, and those agencies are subject to having to come back and deal with the emergency board and do get an independent review by both the executive, if you will, as well as the legislature. So there are other mechanisms Oregon has in place to kind of keep the pressure on of doing that. But certainly, if you know, we are a very public-involved kind of government compared to some states in terms of our citizen boards and commissions. And that's been a value for Oregon. I mean, there's the other side of it in terms of why Oregon chose that approach. But at times it does make it, I would say, at least a little longer process, if not more difficult, to make sure that as we talk about ways to become innovative and to deal with issues, that people are truly on board and that the agencies are following along. But I would not underestimate, even though it's at a higher level, the influence of both the legislature and the Ways and Means, as well as the e-board process, as well as the governor's process.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you.
Well, moving from the overview to the details, I'd like to go back to page 37, Office of Rural Health, Rural Policy. Okay, so there are some federal funds involved, and the reduction will mean that the principal functions of the executive order. What's the executive order? What is that executive order? Well, mainly working to assist rural Oregonians. Explain what will happen with the cuts. I mean, what won't happen with the cuts?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, again, basically this is a position and a half, but a position that is spending, Jim Azzamano, who's spending his time both working with agencies as well as going out to communities and assisting and bringing issues to bear. For example, one of the things he's doing right now is trying to help get people in touch with the fact that you as a body are going out and having hearings around the state and getting people to be part of that process. This is all staff-driven. If the funds aren't there, we reduce staff time. There's less of that work being done. I mean, that's, in effect, I can't tell you exactly. It's not like one function would go away. Less communities are visited. Less work is done around some of the issues, and we would have to prioritize which issues we're going to stay focused on around rural policy issues and which ones we cannot address.
Okay. Then this is kind of a general omnibus kind of position where you deal with a lot of issues, and it doesn't focus on any particular thing.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we're working through that. Again, I think Jim has been on, well, he's newer than I am in the governor's office, I'll put it that way, so he has just barely been on. So we are working on prioritizing how he spends his time, but part of that is also in creation with, as we work this through with this body, about what the highest and best use of his time is.
Well, in my opinion, it's a very important position, and rural Oregon needs a lot of help in economic development, and including health care, including education, and I think that is absolutely money well spent, and I would hate to see any cuts made in this area, but then you have to take it from somewhere else, I guess, but these are proposed cuts, and they may have...
Absolutely. This is completing the process. Yeah. Again, the governor's office at this point would argue until we have numbers updated, that there's probably all of these things are essential to just staying afloat. But
okay, thank you.
I'm going to follow on that same line. The Office of Rural Policy is something I'd like to drill in on a little bit too. I come from a rural place. I represent rural places. I was appointed to this commission and discovered sort of in the early going that it feels a little like assets in search of a mission. And I guess I'm looking for the plan and also the subsequent fallout of that. What happens if the federal funds disappear? Is there a plan if it cannot be sustained with the finance streams that it has? When does the call for it to be funded by general fund come? I mean, I'm just trying to project out ahead. How certain are the federal funds? There was some enthusiasm on the part of some of the participants to have, for example, counties kick in money and not insubstantial money. One of the counties has offered $10,000. But I'm just trying to figure out where does the work plan for that office begin to develop?
Madam Chair, and I'm going to let Ray step in if he's waving his hand back there. Go ahead and acknowledge him because he also works very closely with this program. They are really in work plan development as we speak. Part of it comes out of the executive order, certainly, but the other piece is now that is, in effect, what their first role is actually putting the plan together about the best use of these resources. If you have, in effect, 1.5 staff resources, what is the best way to use that resource to deal with rural issues? Because you're exactly correct. This could be so... there could be so many issues, and the person spreads so thin that, in effect, they can't get anything done. So that is, in effect, one of the first things that's being done is how to best use this resource as a liaison and what are the highest and best use of their time. So as we come forward in the next steps of this process, I think we'll be in a better place to talk more about the detail of what we would see as the highest value for that person's time. In terms of your other question, Madam Chair, about funding streams. I would say it's like any other piece of this budget. At this point, we are not looking for general fund for this. We are truly looking for other for the federal funds and looking at the other funds, both from counties as well as from agency specific. Some of that will ultimately, I think, become an issue down the line, because one of the things that happens when funds come in then is that we need to follow what is that fund intending to buy. Because if it's a dedicated funding source that's asking for this kind of rural help and work to be done, there might be another purpose that this body would say is more important, but we would be obligated to follow that piece, generally speaking. So I think the issue would more likely be, if the funds don't appear, we are much more likely to come and explain to you, this is what we cannot do. And then that just becomes, I would say, another one of the weighing issues for the legislature of, is it a value that outweighs other values?
At the risk of kind of beating this to death, that is something that I really would like to take a look at. And I understand that this is one of these third rail issues, as expressed by Senator Morissette, the importance of having this kind of attention paid to rural Oregon. But I'm also concerned about how they fit in with the work of the economic revitalization teams. And you may have discussed this during my absence, but going back to page 18, and looking at the performance measures and realizing that right now one of the principal performance measures seems to be how many of these certified sites are created. And in other lives and other contexts, I saw the economic revitalization team having a little bit broader swing than just being measured by how many of these sites are certified. One of the things that I would very much like the committee to have in phase two is a copy of the work plan. At one time, the last time I saw one of the work plans, it was exceedingly detailed. And it spoke to a lot of rural stuff. I can think of examples working through sewer issues in Warrenton and places like that. And I just wonder how much in the name of elevating rural issues to a higher profile, we're creating another office that maybe has some duplicative functions of the economic revitalization teams, and that knowing that the money that's going to fund the Office of Rural Policy could be tenuous, and to begin to think in a way that says, how can we do this more efficiently? There are economic revitalization teams, are there not, Mr. Knapp, all over the state?
Yeah, there are nine.
Yes.
In rural places.
Correct.
And so maybe this is a conversation that we ought to start now. And I know just having that Office of Rural Policy had tremendous symbolic value to a number of my colleagues in the building, as well as people that advocated for its creation. But long term, when we can't afford it, how does that rural mindset get inculcated into the work of the economic revitalization teams, so that we're actually less symbolism of the office and more getting it done on the ground?
No, I think that's a good point. We're happy to take a look at both of those issues, as well as, I mean, one of the things that is happening right now is, you are correct, there is a lot of work going on between the two of them, and between rural policy and the economic revitalization teams. But I think looking at how their work plans merge and how they complement each other is certainly something we can take a look at. So,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, thank you. Kind of another follow-up to that. I'm specifically interested in rural health care, and is that something that this particular body deals with, or is that under Karen Whitaker's operation out of OHSU? In other words, if funds are available for doing certain things with health care that we're not accessing presently, would it be this body that would look at that, or is it another body?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, why don't we take a look right now about how are they working together and how restricted are some of those pieces, so we can get you a little more information on that first, and then we can talk about it the next time.
Thanks very much.
Senator Morissette, I might just make the observation from the three meetings I attended before I joined you all in the Senate, and thereby my commission on the commission was terminated. There are as many interests around that table as a person could think up. And just watching the span, there was telecommunications, there were fisheries, there was downtowns revitalization, there was health care. And I think one of the challenges in a one-and-a-half-person shop with a very activist board with exceedingly high expectations is going to be that we're going to end up being about everything and accomplishing nothing, is my real concern. Mm-hmm. And I just know that I am treading in a very touchy place because people have such high expectations. But unless the work scope gets focused pretty quickly, my observation from having participated at the table, albeit only three times, but they were the beginning organizational meetings, they got to get it focused pretty quick. Mr. Neff.
Senator, I guess I would concur with you. I think one of the challenges that we faced as we set about establishing this office is we went around and talked to individuals throughout the state. You could talk to 100 different people, and you would probably have 100 different descriptions of what they expected that office to represent and to do. And I think one of our big challenges is to focus in on what the core plan or mission is, because the office simply cannot be all things to all people. And I do think that's one of the big challenges, and one of the things that Jim Azzamano is currently working on is to manage the expectations of this advisory council that the senator alluded to, because it is a highly activist group, and there does need to be some coordination and careful analysis of exactly what can be accomplished versus saying we're going to accomplish everything and accomplish nothing.
Well, and the concomitant problem that as we figure out where's the funding stream coming from, that you have a county step forward and say, here's a $25,000 contribution, but we're going to take an abrupt turn and we're going to focus on our stuff for Umatilla County. Not that that's bad. But I some evidence, I think, of discipline in that office, or why it is, other than the symbolism, that there has to be an Office of Rural Policy if the economic revitalization teams have the capability of carrying that message forward into the rural places where they live and work. And I invite contradiction from any of my colleagues. You look like you're going to pop, Representative Crum.
I understand your frustration to some extent and concern, and I share it, okay, because there is a statement that we have made as a body, and certainly the governor's office, in saying that we think this is important. It's important for Oregon, okay? The issue is what do we want the Office of Rural Policy to do? What do we want it to become? And at some point, I don't want to look to government for these solutions. We look to OECDD today to do a number of things for us, and I'm highly critical of this particular organization in that I think they create very expensive jobs. And there are lots of small initiatives going on throughout Oregon at the local level where jobs are being created with no government money at all whatsoever. I see the Office of Rural Policy as a facilitator of rural development throughout the state rather than the end all to create it and to make it happen. I think that funding for the office to be able to accomplish its work is incredibly important. We only have a couple of people here, and it's a very small amount of money. And it would seem to me that if this is important to Oregon, then we ought to step up with the general fund to pay for it. If we value what the Office of Rural Policy brings to the table and what it can accomplish in facilitating the transition from traditional rural economies to the new age of global technology and global trade, then we ought to be willing to pay for it as legislators.
This is the risk of poking at you. What if you took the rural out of there and it was a program in OECDD? Would you feel as warm about it?
If it's connected to OECDD, I feel very unwarm about it, frankly. I just came back from a rural development conference, and North Carolina creates many more jobs
with less staff, with less money going out the doors. Their legislature gives all of their state economic development money to a private 501(c) organization. It is not a state organization at all. And they accomplish a lot. The point is, Madam Chair, is that you are absolutely right. To be dependent on other funds and federal funds, if federal funds go away, to get started facilitating and moving the discussions forward, and then to have to pull back, is another one of these herky-jerky motions that we do so often in state government. And I would rather see us just bite the bullet, find some other program in state government that is not accomplishing that which we think it should, eliminate it entirely, and use that funding to a greater and a higher purpose.
Thank you. I agree. I also came back from a conference with healthcare, and the state of West Virginia has a program. It's grant-driven, basically, for rural health. It's an 8-year grant. They're in their sixth year. It's a 501(c)(3) that manages the grant, and the state facilitates. And that's what I would be looking for, is to help. We have established a foundation for rural Oregon that can receive grant money. That's there. We don't have any money to put in it. I was hoping we could use MUPL money.
Which is
that? The MUPL money that should have been used, and I'm hoping we could even, instead of paying, having to pay it back, persuade the feds that we could put it to a good use. But that's what I'm looking at, is a facilitation, and if this office could work with Karen Whitaker's office out of OHSU to help find money from the feds and help establish an independent organization that is non-governmental that could manage a large rotating fund and make loans and grants and get the banks involved to help in community building, that would be wonderful. And that's the reason that I'm interested in this particular committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to throw my two cents in, since we're creating a record here on, I guess, a cautionary and contrary opinion. I think governments have to be very careful when they start giving money to specific private enterprises, whether it's nonprofit or profit, that hold some kind of a specific purpose, because then what you have is you have, because there's the potential for any number of organizations to fulfill the goal that this 501(c)(3) we're talking about hypothetically would fulfill. And then what is the government's role in picking and choosing which organization it's going to support with funding? And I think it's dangerous when we become a granting authority as opposed to one that just takes care of the needs of its people. So there might be a solution in that kind of a process somewhere, but I see it also as creating a potentially different kind of problem for us.
I'd like to have that problem.
Well, and in response, Madam Chair, I would just say look to the example of New Zealand, who a number of years ago under a socialist government realized that they were broke financially and they had to change some things. And so what they did, in essence, was look to a number of private organizations. Some were private religious organizations. And they, frankly, did away, they were funding monies to these private organizations, and there was a tremendous duplication, and they frankly picked two or three of those organizations that had the best track record and took the money away from everyone else. There was a great hue and cry, but they actually over the years proved that they could do much better in terms of delivery of services by choosing those who had successful outcomes, had proven programs. And I would think that that would be a better solution rather than us creating larger bureaucracies which are less responsive to the needs of the people that they serve.
Representative Avakian.
Or that maybe what you're describing is really kind of a free enterprise system where various private organizations go out to provide a service and then compete. And as opposed to the government simply becoming a funnel for taxpayer dollars to private entities. The risk inherent in that is that the government then is able to control the free enterprise system. which is a danger that you cannot be avoided once we just become a conduit for public money to private corporations.
The model I have in mind, you know, the state disappears basically after it gets started. The state is a facilitator to help attract some funds and setting up the mechanism, and then it would be under the Office of Rural Health Care, I guess. And but it would basically be a 501c3 that would provide the services along with some of the private entities. So I think it would work.
Ms. McHugh.
Madam Chair, I think very good questions raised. And again, I think one of the things that we do owe you is more information on what the current status is of the work plan. And again, as we talked about, I think one of the things that we have tried to focus on with folks externally is that economic revitalization team is more project-oriented, and you're correct, it's more than just industrial-ready sites. Most of our measurement leads to those, but it is broader than that. The Office of Rural Policy says policy because we are dealing with one person to try and do that, but I think we owe you some more information on where it sits today, and I think looking at a number of issues here about the best way to deal with that.
Good. With that departure, Dallas, I think you have a comment.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to something that's kind of a dry topic here.
Imagine that a CPA taking us to a dry topic. Wonders never cease.
But this is following on Senator Morse's line of concern about the role of the governor and how much control or authority he exerts or demonstrates. We have introduced this a little bit with a commentary that in the executive department, the Constitution has the executive department, legislative department, and judicial department. In the executive department, there are three constitutional offices, that of the treasurer, secretary of state, and the governor. By law, not by constitution, but by law, we've exempted the secretary of state and the treasurer from a certain budgetary oversight. We've exempted it from basically having to balance or be part of the governor's balanced budget. And the reason I bring that up is it's starting to be somewhat problematic is that we've seen some holes created in the budget just with this budget document that's been presented. My specific question is, I guess, of the committee and maybe of Ms. McHugh also, is there any, I'm trying to get a sense as if there's a problem with that statute. Is do you feel that the governor's office should be coming forward with a balanced budget and should be not exempt certain the other two offices in the executive department from adhering to the same rules?
Well, I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Vakian.
You're looping right back to those questions we had before, I think, on who has the budgetary authority over various agencies and within the various electeds. And I think that is just such an unclear. I mean, you're asking a terrific question, but the question is, when you have an executive branch of government, who's in charge of the executive branch, or do we really have a committee that's in charge of the executive branch?
Madam Chair, that's where I was heading. I think the Constitution is clear that the governor is responsible for the balanced budget. And it was a statutory exemption that the legislature provided both the Secretary of State and Treasurer's office from that. And so you could undo that by repealing that statute and put the governor, again, in charge of that.
Ms. McHugh.
Madam Chair, I think, again, by the Constitution, so, for example, the governor may not have higher fire authority over the agency director of a commission-run agency, but he does clearly have the authority to develop a balanced budget. I think that what Dallas is referring to with those two, the only comment I would have is in terms of kind of the dynamic of the problem for a governor with a balanced budget when you're talking about what's not part of the executive control, the treasurer's office has, in effect, no general fund, and the secretary of state is relatively minor. It really probably more problematic is the judicial branch is really the largest entity that, in effect, you have a chief justice recommended budget. And what you have seen governors do as we went into the 90s and as the general fund became tighter and tighter in terms of that is apply a formula and, in effect, say, I don't have the authority to say how a chief justice will make priority decisions, but the executive branch is at X percent relative to the general fund, and we're going to apply that to the legislative and judicial because they don't have to make their recommendations within those dollars. If you did not do that, I think you would have another problem. Unless you actually change the Constitution to give the governor the authority over the judicial and legislative branch to say, here's what I recommend for your budgets, which is a whole other issue, I think you would still be in the situation where if you said the governor must put in whatever the Chief Justice recommends, then you would have an executive branch budget that, in effect, would put you in a situation of a fully funded or could be a fully funded judicial branch budget that or even new efforts. So it's a interesting dynamic. But certainly Dallas is not incorrect about the Treasurer and Secretary of State. The only thing I would say is those are relatively minor in the scope of the whole budget.
Representative Avakian.
Well, it sounds like you're making a distinction between the governor's authority to put together a general fund's budget and for him to manage the other fund balances within the executive branch.
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, in terms of what I would say the distinction is that, again, in terms of what I think Dallas is raising as an issue for the on the budget side, because, again, when I earlier answered the question about governor's authority, I was looking at it broader than just budget recommendation. I was looking at it from, I think, kind of the full management scope. But relative to Dallas's question, which I thought had to do with the fact that as we put those budgets forward, then they do not come with a lot of necessarily the detail of how does that budget stay in balance, the ones that are outside the governor's control. And all I would offer is that on the other funds or dedicated funding source, the difference is that, in effect, because there is no, as long as the budget balance of the revenue support the expenditure, the governor does not have to come in and artificially by percentage make a reduction there. So it doesn't put the legislature in quite the same bind. I don't think that the legislative fiscal office has quite the same concern around the other funds pieces that they do around the general fund.
Sometimes you do.
But it still gets back to the issue of span of control and authority. And it appears to me that we have an organizational structure that really doesn't lend itself to focusing on management of government as opposed to just kind of a distant relationship. Recognizing the governor does have a lot of authority, but you can solve problems after the fact, or you can be proactive in an administrative management sense and solve them before the fact. And it sounds to me like we're probably a model that lends itself more to get a blow-up than you go out and replace an agency head kind of a relationship. And I'm just a little troubled about the kind of way we're organized.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think the good news is that when you look nationally, Oregon still does pretty well in terms of our primary agencies not seeing kind of what I call the routine replacement of agency heads, but dealing with issues proactively. And yes, in some cases it's by other means of cooperation than maybe direct means that would exist under some other org charts. So it's kind of developed, I think, in terms of how that happens. But while it happens, you're correct that sometimes it's through some interesting statutory obstacles.
Anything more on this?
Madam Chair, I was trying to test the water to see if anyone would have a problem repealing the law that exempted specifically the Secretary of State and the Treasurer from the budgetary review and authority that the Governor's Office has over most other agencies.
Actually, I have a little enthusiasm for it, then the least of which is, and for the edification of the committee, we will not be meeting on Wednesday and Thursday because the Secretary of State's office is not prepared and has not followed the instructions for the budget process. We will not be here on Wednesday.
There you go.
Wednesday and Thursday.
So we could draft a committee bill in the meantime.
Dallas, were you suggesting that you think that statute might be in conflict with our constitutional obligations?
Not at all, Mr. Chair. Representative, members of the committee, I believe the statute was put in place as an accommodation passed for something that was perceived. And I think it also exempts higher education from certain things. I'm not remembering exactly. Throughout the statute, there are certain exemptions from gubernatorial oversight, but they are strictly put in statute. I think you could repeal that law that exempts those two offices from his oversight and not be in conflict with the Constitution.
I might exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask the professional staff to bring those citations in. We'll take a look at
them. It would also...
Representative Vakia.
Along with the citations, it would be very interesting to see if back when they were passed, if there were either legislative counsel or attorney general opinions on the matter. And if there were, I wouldn't mind seeing those.
Thank you. Senator Morris.
I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. Well, again, I apologize for being a little out of sync with the committee, but I am coming inexorably to the conclusion as people are gathering up their stuff that we have reached the end of your presentation. We'll expect some additional information, I think, in phase two. And absent any questions or comments by the committee, and I see none, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5512. Remind us that we will be here tomorrow, Tuesday at 8:30, and adjourn.